huge news, years in the making, my brand new book that my publishers refuse to publish, Money Matrix. Beat the money system and build generational wealth. Understand the three main ways that the banks productize you and make money from you. You'll be able to turn that system against itself, build generational wealth and multiple streams of recurring income. It's all at moneymatrix.cash. And if you're quick, the first few hundred registrants and buyers will receive many special bonuses from me. The brand new Moneymaker Summit 3-day special event. Meet me at a champagne reception. Meet me at a multi-millionaire networking dinner. Go now, moneymatrix.cash. This is huge.
Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast.
What does the word disruptive mean to you?
It means going beyond the ordinary, going beyond the status quo.
Not thinking in the conventional way, not just sort of following the herd.
Disruptive means shaking things up, you know?
Disruptive entrepreneur is somebody who sees the problem and embraces the problem with a new way.
Shake up, an awakening.
Quality will take care of itself, and you'll go from being disruptive, but also profitable.
When you use your own reservoir of talent, when you love what you do, then you disrupt.
Mix it up, change it up, and dominate.
And now, your host, 8 times best-selling author and double world record holder, Rob Moore.
Hello, and welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. It's producer Harry here once again. Now, just give me a few minutes to set the scene, because this has got to be the craziest podcast interview we've done in almost 6 years of doing the show. So this interview is with the secret first son of the notorious drug lord, Pablo Escobar. The Philip Whitcomb, who refers to himself as Roberto Santoyo Escobar, claims to be the first son of Pablo Escobar. His story recently went viral. He's just written a book about his journey and his story, and he's been all over the BBC, Sky, lots of different media outlets, and everyone talking about his story. So his story is, you know, he was fathered by Pablo Escobar in secret, and as a kid, he eventually was adopted and grew up in the UK, and it wasn't until he was 24 till he found out who his real father was. And in the interview, he gets into all the details about what happened. So we agreed to do the interview, and about a week or so before the interview, things went really crazy. Things that in almost 6 years of doing the show, it hasn't happened before. Lots of information was being leaked to us and people getting in touch claiming that Philip made the story up. There was inaccuracies with the story, and all this information started trickling in. So doing a lot of research into this interview, we were left very confused and kind of in an awkward position. We were left with either, should we cancel the interview or should we go ahead? And a lot of you who voted in Rob's Facebook community polls decided, no, you should go ahead and still do this interview. This isn't Rob's or the podcast style to expose people. That's not what this platform and this podcast has ever been about. But we kind of did want to get to the root of what was going on here, because there was clearly bigger things happening in the background than a normal podcast interview. So what I would encourage you guys to do is sit down, listen, and tell us what you think. Do you think what Philip is saying in this interview is legitimate and correct and his story stacks up and makes sense and you believe it? Or do you think that this isn't what it seems? Like I said, we've never done a podcast interview like this at all. We've never done any interview like this at all. And this is completely different and unique for us. So let us know what you think. It's best that we don't put our opinion on you. You can make up your own mind of what you think of this. Now, obviously, this is something really weird and completely different to anything we've ever done on the podcast. So if you like it, let us know. Maybe we could end up doing more content like this, you know, outside of just entrepreneur and business people, but going down this route. So let us know what you think. Also, this interview has kind of opened a lot of doors and a lot of other things have come out. So make sure that you're staying tuned to this podcast, because there is going to be a lot more discussion with this particular story and other content coming out. So just stay tuned. We also have a YouTube channel where we produce lots of videos from our podcast to Rob doing some content as well. So if you want to see the video version of this particular interview, head over to Rob Moore on YouTube and subscribe. Also, we made a behind the scenes video of the chaotic 24 hours before about what went on behind the scenes and the whole day doing this interview. So if that's something you want to see, again, head over to Rob Moore on YouTube and subscribe for that. Right, that's enough from me. So let's just get straight into the interview with the secret son of Pablo Escobar. And remember, if you don't risk anything, you risk everything.
Hi, it's Rob Moore here. And yeah, there's been a lot of noise about this interview. And I'm very grateful that Roberto Santoyo Escobar Also known as Philip Whitcomb, but for the sake of this discussion, we're going to talk to him in his original birth name, Roberto. I guess you could say the secret son of Pablo Escobar in some ways. So let's just get straight off, Roberto, if that's all right, because I'd love to hear the story from you. I know there's a lot of people making out shenanigans about your story, but you wrote the book, it's your story. So why don't you tell us about the whole story? Give us your, as long as you want to go, your life story.
Yeah, well, obviously, I'm not going to go 288 pages on your programs all straight away. But yeah, I mean, interesting, just to start off with, when I started writing the book, I mean, there are various stages. I mean, I started making notes on bits of paper. There was no intention to write a book. I don't consider myself, if you like, to be a proper author. I'm just a sort of ordinary person, if you like, that's decided to turn what I'd written in note form into a book. And I've had help. You know, I'm not the only person that's been involved in the book, in the sense that you have editors and people, professionals who know how to put things and what have you in all together. So it's encouraging for everyone out there. It's possible to sit down and write a book, even if you're not Enid Blyton, you know. So what I was saying was, what's interesting is that when I started formulating all my notes into what we now see as a book, I did actually call it A Secret Son. That was the original title, but the publishers have decided it should be called something else, so that's fine. So effectively, a lot of the book is written in various ways. So there's research, there's memories from my childhood, loads of photographs that I had from my childhood, and research that the publishers, editors have done for me as well. So you put it all together and you've got a book. But that wasn't enough. We had to actually then fit in some to make it a story. There had to be some bits that were sort of logically obvious. There were conversations between people, but as we went there, kind of thing, that's been added and fitted in. So there are bits of the book that have been added and fitted in. Yeah. I mean, it's a controversial book in several ways, because it talks about the prequel to Narcos. So, you know, Narcos, which is one of the most successful stories, you know, that's been around in the last 10, 15 years or whatever it was. This tells the story of how it all began. And of course, you know, we've got involvement of British Secret Service and American Secret Service in a foreign country, which is a typical situation that goes on, and it's an involvement in basically the printing of money for the country through a private limited company, which is a famous company, and there are other things that go on in between. There are similarities as well to some of Ian Fleming's stories as well, which is quite interesting. But I think that was the style of writing that I was thinking about, bearing in mind that my dad, when I call him dad, my adopted father, who was the MI6 spy, he in fact, his boss in De La Rue was actually knew Ian Fleming. So there were similarities there, and the office in Regent Street was one of the kind of, you know, when Bond walks in and throws his hat on the hat stand, it was there. There are similarities there. But yeah, I mean, throughout my childhood, none of us knew, none of my family knew what Dad was up to. He was just a managing director of a British security firm working abroad. And this is why, you know, you know, a lot of people would think it's so incredulous that it must be just a load of rubbish, but it isn't. It's all true. I mean, obviously, as I said before, there are bits in the book you have to fill in some gaps, because you can't just say things without filling in the gaps. You've got to tell a story. But yeah, the story effectively has come about by the fact that I've had this sort of weird childhood and some quite traumatic experiences. And I'm not the only one to have traumatic experiences in the world. You know, a lot of people do have these problems. And I had these traumatic experiences and memories. And there came a moment in time in my life when I was living on the Costa del Sol in 1989, when my adopted father decided he had to tell me some things. And it started from there, where a lot of stuff in my childhood became explained, because the stuff that happened that I hadn't had explained to me properly. And so we had these conversations, and you know, it all culminated from there. And it took a long time to fill all the gaps in. And even today, I don't have all the answers. So it's not going to be pretending I have all the answers, because I don't have them all today. I mean, it's very difficult to write a book like this, because you just don't have all the answers. You don't have all the memories. You just have as much as you possibly can, and you put as much of it you can together. And this is what's happened. You end up with a book like this, and it is treading on eggshells, and, you know, it goes through a minefield without blowing up mines. And you know, and some people get upset by, you know, some of the things that are said, but I tried not to implicate anyone in the things that my adopted father did and the things that he got on up to in within the confines of his job. I mean, it's just like a Bond thing where he went down to another country with this cover story as a security personnel officer for a British firm, but they were doing other stuff. It's quite common. It goes on today. And effectively, they helped make the country that exists today, and they helped, and they did a lot of good in the country. But, you know, to get involved in find out where all this money was going and everything else that's in the book, they being my adopted father, he had to get involved with these people, and that's what the story's about. But most of it's about what he told me, and that's fine. And, you know, what can I say? It's the most important thing here is, you know, you pay your $14.99 and you enjoy the book as a story, and don't get too hung up about stuff, because although it's based on my true life that I remember, you know, it's important that you just enjoy the book as a story. And if there's any controversy, well, you know, the people involved, you know, just enjoy the book. That's what I'm saying. Quite a large portion of my income from the book, I won't say how much, obviously, is going to help, you know, children within families in the UK that are suffering from problems like that. I mean, I really was one of the main reasons to do this, because I was trying to readdress the situation that went on in Colombia that basically launched the cocaine trade. Not opium, and all that came from the East. You know, the drugs have been going on for a lot longer. But the cocaine trade that we recognize today is, you know, all started back then in Colombia, really.
So that conversation that your adopted father had with you, I know, you know, there's a lot of common questions you probably got asked, and I won't on those, because we'll make it different. But can you take us through that timeline? You know, what he told you in terms of who he really is, and, you know, what the events that unfolded were when he sat down and told you, and how old were you?
Yeah, so it was 1989, so I was 24, but there's a lot of complicated issues around even that question, which I do answer in the book.
I've got time.
Yeah, I know what you're edging at, but the book answers.
No, you don't. You don't know what I'm edging at.
Yeah. I wasn't born yesterday, you know. What I'm trying to say to you is that it is a very complicated story, and I've tried to explain it as best as possible in the book. It's perfectly reasonable for you to ask the questions, though. And there are some things that you, when you're writing a book, you have to hook your memory onto something. And I remember that we went to see Full Metal Jacket that first night. So obviously now we've got Google and that, you can research when that came out of the cinema in Madrid and stuff. And so that helps you with dates and times. So when you're researching, thank goodness now we've got the internet to help us. Because when I started this, I didn't have any of that. So it was all just memories and postcards and notes and stuff. And so it was a lot more difficult than it as in the last sort of 6 years, where I was able to, I was well enough, because I suffered a lot of mental health problems trying to go back into my childhood. And it was only in the last 6 years that I've actually been able to sit down and type on a modern laptop to write the book. So, but effectively, to answer your question in a simplistic manner, there were a set of circumstances happening in Colombia whereby this chap called Pablo Escobar Gaviria was getting himself into trouble by now, to put it mildly. And also in Madrid, my adoptive father was not well, although he hadn't told us. So a culmination of circumstances where he decided it was best to come clean and talk to me. I think he was going to anyway at some stage, but there were things that I needed answered questions to. And we started this conversation and it went on for, until he died effectively. And so from the age of 24, living in Sotogrande on the southern coast of Spain, I was designing a golf course with Peter Alice on the Costain land. And so we were out there, he was saying, where he wanted stuff, and being an artist, I could draw it for him. And we had a lot of fun doing that. And then I get this phone call. As you know, the Costa del Sol in the 80s was a pretty wild west place of it anyway. And there's all the sort of drug money being laundered there. But I was just there designing his golf courses. And dad called me and said, I need to talk to you. And it started there. I went up. And we went out to watch the movie, and then he started talking to me about his life, not about me. It was more about his life to start with, and what he was doing and stuff, and what he was doing in Karachi, for example, talking to me about the BCCI business, and it was all quite incredible. But there were things that rang true, and I could just identify with some of the things, because he'd say things like, when I went away that Christmas and I wasn't with the family. It's, you remember that? And you say, I went to Panama and I had to see this guy. And you remember that guy on the golf course? So we went through this sort of conversation, identifying moments where I was present. And then him explaining to me stuff about my life. So it's a long, drawn-out process. It's not some simplistic overnight thing. But effectively, he felt that my life was not as safe as it should be at that time because of this other guy who was losing control of his business. Now, when Dad said to me, your real father, because you're adopted and your real father is Pablo Escobar Gaviria, I didn't even know he was. We didn't have internet in the Costa del Sol then. We didn't have tablets and phones that we all had this knowledge. We had Gibraltar TV, which is 2 years behind everywhere else. And we just lived this world, a life that was totally different then. Now, 8-year-old kids know everything. It's all on Google. But back then we didn't know. So it just didn't mean a lot to me. So there was a lot of explaining to do. And even then, it was just sort of this mystery man that we met in Medellin once a year. So it wasn't this big thing, and we hadn't had Narcos. There wasn't this big news about this person. So it wasn't the dramatic thing that you might imagine today, someone telling you that. It just wasn't that. It was just a person. And, Dad gave me some paperwork, and I just sort of shrugged my shoulders and went, okay. And he said, I'm going to put some bodyguards at your house. And he did. Before I got back down to Sotogrande, which is a flight from Madrid down to Malaga, by the time I'd driven down the 340 to Sotogrande, I had guards at the house. And which Dad paid for Group 4, and it was just back to the old days, effectively. So, and it was from there that he started coming down to see me, and we carried on the conversations and so on. It was not as simple as it sounds. It was a long-term relationship with my adopted father that I started building with him again, because I hadn't seen him for a while. It was a relationship that I started to get to know him. And I noticed he had a withered hand, a bit withered, and started talking to him about that. And it turns out that he'd got motor neuron disease, but we didn't really know that at the time. But it was obvious he wasn't well. So that's where it started. But it wasn't this, this drug lord or anything, because we didn't know about these things. We just didn't have that knowledge in those days.
So you said you'd be taken to Colombia to see him once a year, but you didn't know who he was then. Is that what you just said?
No, I wasn't. No. I wasn't taken to Colombia once a year. We were living in Colombia.
Hi, it's Rob here, interrupting you with something you may not know about me. I was one of the few people on the planet hand-selected by Facebook to pilot their new supporter program. It's a very small premium model where you can get exclusive content and advance notice or discount of new products and services. So this is what I've done for you. Not only can you get best discounts for any training that we might run. Not only do you get notified first of any launches we do, we also do supporter meetups, supporter dinners, supporter WhatsApp groups where you have a deeper community. I do supporter only Ask Me Anythings. I do supporter only content and podcasts. We have a community of 2,500 supporters, and I'd love to give you the chance to be one of those. I believe this is the best supporter program in the whole world. Find me a better one, but I don't think you will. So the link is bit.ly/RobSupporter with a capital R. That's bit.ly/RobSupporter with a capital R. I believe the gap between free content and paid content is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. There's a lot of free content out there that's maybe not that good. And for just a few dollars a month, you can get the best content on business, on entrepreneurship, on starting up, on scaling up, on sales, on marketing, on the mindset of being an entrepreneur. So go to bit.ly/RobSupporter with a capital R right now.
In the book, you will note that we used to once a year during my childhood, whilst we were living in Colombia, we used to go to Medellin, and we used to see, right. We used to go to this ballroom and in this big hotel in Medellin, and in this big hotel was where I used to meet this chap. But I didn't know who he was. It was just something that happened. I've described it in detail in the book. It was just part of my childhood. It was like, you know, you have to go and sit there with these people. But I had bodyguards, and I always felt safe. My bodyguards were my friends. They became my friends. It was, they were just nice guys. And it was a shame one of them got killed. But that's, you know, it's all described in the book how it happened and why.
This is obviously what I'm trying. I just want you to sort of relax a bit, because I'm not trying to like catch you out or anything. I'm trying to get sort of a journey of the story, because obviously it is really complicated, as you've said.
It is complicated.
You know, your real dad, your adopted dad, because you said you didn't see your dad for a while. And I guess that's your adopted dad.
You're right. When I'm 17, 18, you know, I left boarding school and I went to live with my parents in Walton-on-Thames, my adopted parents, permanently. And they sent me to art school, and dad went off to do his missions. He was still working. No, I thought he was still working for De La Rue, and he went up to Basingstoke and that, but he used to swan off, you know, all over the place. So I didn't really see him very often. So my life was basically the local rugby club, working a pub in the evening to earn some extra cash, and art college during the day. That was my life. And, you know, I had a little Honda C50, and I used to whiz about and play rugby on Saturdays. So I had this normal, what you might call a normal life. And you know, my adopted mother was at home, and my adopted sister worked in the hospital up the road, and we just had this life. But dad was always swanning off doing stuff. So when I said I didn't know him very well, because he you know, I was at boarding school, and then I come home to live as an 18-year-old, and he's off doing all these other things. But he sent me postcards from wherever he was, and I have postcards from Medellin from that time when he was off, you know, and send me postcards from there. So I used to collect all the postcards, which I suppose were the WhatsApp messages of their day. And they were all dated and stamped, which is very useful for when you're writing a book. Otherwise, they don't mean much. But so the timeline there is that was the time when I thought, oh, well. And then when I started talking to him again, when he was become more available, he wasn't working for De La Rue anymore. He was working for Brinks in Madrid, but he was still doing stuff. And that's when we started getting to know each other again. So there was a rejuvenation of our relationship, which was very nice. But it's a shame it didn't last very long.
And why do you think he told you when he did?
Well, the timing is quite simple. But I look back now and think, oh, well, that's obvious. But at the time, there's no explanation as to why. But if you look back, you'll see in 1989, there was a bit of an issue, and Don Pablo ended up in this so-called prison of his in the Catedral. And you know, the empire was falling to pieces. And Dad obviously, you know, is fully aware of all this. I mean, I don't have all the answers, but it's obvious that you know, after he told me that, you know, there are problems with your real father and I need to put security in your house, I can obviously put two and two together and understand that there must have been some kind of don't mess with anyone in that family. And now there's no control or such. It's all logical. I'm putting it together. Two and two equals four. Obviously, he sees now that any, you know, anyone involved in the family or the gang, if you like, is all dispersed. And, you know, he's on his own in this. In this place with a few of his henchmen, and that's it. So the great empire is crumbling, and anyone related to him is probably in a bit of danger. But I didn't perceive any of that. I'm just getting on with my life. It's a bit difficult to see how I could see my life. It was actually, I didn't see any of this. It was Dad that saw this. And because
for years, people have been asking me where I buy my watches. Many of you may know I'm a watch collector, I'm a watch investor, and those as an asset class have done me very well in the last 15 years. I have never shared where I source my watches from or my watch dealer until now. My watch dealer used to be a professional footballer for Manchester United, and he formed a watch brand called Broadwalk. And he sources the higher-end brands like Rolex, Audemars Piguet, Patek Philippe and Richard Mille. I trust him, I've used him for many years, and recently we've done a partnership. Hence, I'm inviting you, if you want to start investing in watches and protect your money from the banks and inflation, to check out Broadwalk. That's Broadwalk. And the website is broadwalkgroup.com. The email is sales@broadwalkgroup.com. And please don't share this, but his number is 07496 878153. Obviously, only message him if you're serious about buying and investing in the higher end watches. People have been asking me for years, and for the first time ever, you can get access to my watch team.
Obviously, he was still busy on Operation Durazno, which was tracking and effectively providing the information for these services to go in. And they did in the end. And they went in and got all their money back when they raided Panama.
Right. So earlier you said, you know, there was some trauma in your childhood. But of course, back then you didn't know who your real dad was. No. So are you okay to talk about what was causing you, you know, trauma and issues when you were growing up?
Yeah, so when I still get these problems today. I mean, they're not massive problems now because I've become more able to understand them. Because that's one of the therapeutic processes is to write it all down on paper or a computer, or whatever you want. It doesn't have to be a book, but get it out of your head and write it down. And if it's explained in a linear format, it helps your mental health problems. But yeah, I mean, in the very early days, I hardly ever went a night without nightmares and screaming and shouting and all sorts of problems very early on. And these were never explained to me. And in these conversations I had with Dad, I kept saying to him, why did I keep thinking about several things? You know, so these aren't massive memories. So I don't want anyone to think, oh, yeah, well, it's impossible for him to remember all that. You're right, it is impossible. But you'd be surprised what a child, even very young, absorbs into their brain. And I absorbed these horrific, flashy memories, only very, very small, you know, second type memories where I remember, for example, a lime green wall with paint peeling off it. And I remember a milk bottle on a ledge with some bars there. And I remember a woman lying or in front of me somewhere. I don't know where now. It's not really very clear in a red dress. And I remember just very loud bangs. And that's all I remember from that period. But it created these, you know, wake up 2 a.m. screaming and frightened. And so I presume they were flashbacks to a very early time. And eventually I coaxed it out of Dad, what he explained what he thought those were. And that's why the opening chapter of the book is a very emotional tale of just filling in gaps. I mean, you can't write down something that happened in that time without filling in the gaps, because it's just little flash memories. And then Dad explained to me that, you know, what happened and how they found this little baby in the back of this room. And that baby was me. And they, you know, he had been with this woman who said she was my mother. When she died, it turns out she was a young girl and her dress was actually covered in blood. So that must have been what I was having a nightmare about. But, you know, I can't guarantee that's what it was. But that's, you have to put stuff together like that, because it's the only way you can deal with explaining things. So that's how I dealt with that, by putting that together in that. And it does equal, you know, it did equal my nightmares, the explanation. Dad did not want to tell me about that. I had to really, you know, I badgered him about that for a long time. It was not good. He didn't want to talk about it. Being a secretive man anyway, you know, it's hard to get stuff out of these people. They are professional secret hiders. You know, they hide secrets very well in the back of their head. And he was able to compartmentalize his life into two halves. You know, he was able to be this guy that worked for the Secret Service, and he was able to be just a lovely family man as well. So those people that knew him back then, and I'm answering some critics now, those people that knew Dad back in Colombia, they only knew the nice businessman, the nice guy who was the family man, and you know, that's the only guy they knew. They didn't know this other stuff. So yes, it is incredible to imagine that this went on. But I mean, that is the point of the Secret Service. This whole word "secret" is what it means. You know, you are able to infiltrate places and organizations without anybody knowing who you are. In fact, if you get found out, you're likely to get killed. So they have to be very good at their jobs, and they are today. For sure.
So how would you say, Roberto, your life was and is different before you knew who your real dad is, and after, and now you know who your real dad is? Because that must almost be like two separate lives in a way.
Yeah, I mean, the life that someone from the outside looking in wouldn't see any difference, because I'm just a kid at art college, or I just went to school. But on the outside, it looks like I'm a spoiled, rich kid living the expat lifestyle with wealthy people all around me, and going to private school that cost a fortune, and, you know, getting jetting around across the Atlantic all over the shop, you know, and all the rest of it. And then I go to private art college in London, paid for, you know, so it looks like I've got this amazing, private, upper class privileged lifestyle, which, you know, I did have really. And then I just carry on, and I've got work on the Costa del Sol as a graphic designer. So it doesn't look on the surface that there are these two separate issues. But in my head, once I find out, I knew I was adopted, obviously, because they told me, which is quite a sort of a weird, surreal experience, because I didn't know what the word adopted meant. I was quite young, and it was quite weird. But when Dad tells me this, yes, you're right. In my head, not that anyone else would have noticed, but in my head, suddenly my life is, I view my own life in a totally different way after that. It's just really weird. So what was it like? It was suddenly like discovering that you've lived this whole life, and then suddenly you discover that you've got this whole other life that you could have lived, but you didn't. And it's very, very weird. Not that it made any difference. I still got up in the morning, got on my Honda C50 and off to art college. You know, you still do that. But there's this weird thing in your head thinking, crikey, I'm not the person I thought I was. Not, you can't do anything about it. I mean, what can you do? You just get on with your life. But, you know, when I was going off to art college and that, I just knew that I had a strange child. It wasn't normal as such, but I didn't know anything then. I just remember all these weird experiences. And then so later on, when I've sort of got a family and everything, Dad tells me stuff, I suddenly realized that it's all a bit serious, you know. But I was coming to terms with massive other traumas in my life that overshadowed that. So to everyone else who reads the book, people reading the book think, oh, well, that must be the most amazing, thing that's happening in his life, and how is he coping with that? I wasn't dealing with that at the time. I was dealing with, you know, my wife, who was, you know, had this terrible headaches, and so, you know, I've got a couple of years in between when Dad tells me and when my wife starts getting ill, and it was terrible because we're just sitting on the patio in our house in Sotogrande, Grande, and she got up one afternoon to go and get some more drinks from the fridge, and she started walking around in circles. And I just, I thought she'd had a bit too much PIMS, to be honest. And, I've got my life set up, the wife, the kids, a nice little house, we've got some money, we're okay. And suddenly this happens, and it turns out that she's got a brain tumor in her head the size of a tennis ball and about a week to live. And I just couldn't believe it. My whole life just fell to pieces. And then Dad's telling me this stuff. It's not really a priority, to be honest. Priority, shit, what am I going to do with my life? It's falling to pieces. And so, obviously, Costa del Sol, 80s, I'm thinking, right, I need to get back to England. So, you know, it was terrible. So, you know, suddenly money becomes short. I've got problems with my wife getting a tumor, and the doctors have told me she's dying, you know, and all this shit going on. It's really, it was not good. And it caused my brain to just go bang. And I had, after she died, in 93, I mean, oh, what a year. I mean, 93, Dad dies of motor neurone disease, and I'm sat on his bed whilst he's dying, which will lead into another obvious question later. But and then my wife dies, and I'm sat on her bed watching her die, which is a terrible experience. I wouldn't wish it on anyone. And then, you know, the news later on in December, bang, oh, that guy Dad's telling me about, it was my dad, oh, he's been shot in the head. Ah, the hell, what a year. And then it all just collapsed in on me, and I suffered really bad mental health problems, and I ended up in the ward in Ashford St. Peter's Hospital on the mental health ward, and I was very ill. And it took, you know, I don't know, a year to year and a half, whatever, to get better. I was very ill, not good, but I came out the other end, fighting fit.
So there's a couple of things I want to ask, but first on that, because I think that could be useful to people. How did you pull yourself out of that hole? How did you get yourself mentally better?
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things is doing what I'm doing now is don't be embarrassed by it, you know. Everybody, and including you, Rob, you would have suffered depression through your life somewhere along the line. If you haven't, you will do, I promise you. It is something that happens to everybody. We do live in a terrible world.
Yeah, I get it.
Even if you've got millions, you will have problems that will get you depressed. And it's just the level of depression that you will suffer is different in different people. I was great coping with everything, and suddenly, bang, it was like a massive implosion, and boof, I was gone. You know, I started drinking and went into a big downward spiral. And, you know, my kids were being looked after by grandparents. It was all really bad news. How did I get out of it? Well, the trick is you talk to people and you get people to help you. You don't man up and go, nothing wrong with me, Gov, because that doesn't work. You end up dead. You have to talk to people and you have to accept their help. And of course, they put you on these tablets, you know, and the tablet's almost as bad as the bloody problem. But apparently it works. And, you know, it took a long time. And, you know, you've got to talk to people, go to the therapy, do the thing, even though you don't want to and you think it's stupid, I don't need this, you know, all that. You just got to talk to people. And there's a whole team out there in England and UK and Surrey, where I was, there's a whole team out there helping. And, you know, I had health visitors and everybody else. They all want you to succeed. No one's against you. And eventually I pulled out of it. But one of the things I had to do was I had to stop drinking alcohol. And I had to stop smoking and stop relying on the crutches of these. These are crutches that you rely on. Stop all that, turn it in, and just get clean and just, you know, get realistic about life. Do the school run, get the sort of thing going, you know, and then it starts to get better. But it takes a long time, and I'm not sure you properly recover from depression, really. And I know you don't recover from alcoholism properly. You just got to stop drinking. But it's still there. There's still a time when I think, yeah, a large rum and coke go down nice. But obviously I say no. But there's a moment, you know. And after dinner, the best one after a Sunday lunch, is like, oh, yes, I could just do with a big fat Henry Winterman, you know. But you just got to say no. You've got to control yourself and say no, and then I'm all right. But it does take a lot of strength, and it takes a lot of help from other people and friends, and you get through it. So out there, guys, you know, and girls, you will recover, but you've got to rely on other people. Don't pretend you know how to deal with it all. Because if you do, you will be in a lot of trouble, and a lot of people are.
Right. So let's fast forward quite a few years. You've had a load of media interest since you've released the book. So you released it. Can you, first off, just let us know when you released the book? It's quite recent, isn't it?
Yeah, it was August the 6th this year. So it's not been out long. There's a long process.
Where you're gonna get it.
I don't know if you know what they called it, but it's called Son of Escobar, I believe, the book. Is that right?
Yeah. So I called it Secret Son to start with. But it's a normal process. You know, when you're writing, you have ideas, and then the professionals come along and they help you, and they've got all the marketing gear and all the rest of it. So, yeah, I mean, I thought, you know, and this is like a surprise, and it will be to a lot of people, will be able to identify this when they write books. You write a book and the publisher picks you up, and then they take over. It's like a truck, you know, they go off and do all their stuff. And so they got this marketing team in, and then the next minute you've got your PR person telling you you've got a live at 10 o'clock and a 3 o'clock here and a 4 o'clock there. And before you know it, you don't know whether to have a shave or a shower. So, you know, that's what happens. It wasn't my doing. It's the publishers do this, and they're very professional. So, you know, hats off to them. But I mean, you know, we're talking about a book, which it's a story about a little boy and his experiences. But the problem is his experiences touch on a lot of big sort of government secret stuff and all the rest of it. And so it causes controversy just because of that. And so,
Roberto, how since the book's out and all this media attention with critics and with people who are, you know, a fan of the book, how's that been? You know, how's your life changed in the last month?
It has changed my life completely. You know, I used to self-promote myself with my paintings that you can see on the back, you know, or I'll have a Facebook page of my artwork and I'll have a Facebook page about this and about that, as we all do, because we're all like, aren't we? We just want to promote our stuff, what we're doing. And then suddenly it's like, whoa, wait a minute, there's this big truckload of machinery behind me promoting the book. I don't need this stuff anymore. So one of the first things I did was get rid of my Facebook pages. I've just got a private profile now, and Instagram, all that stuff. Actually, gone. And
why did you get rid of all that? Because you could sell more books, couldn't you, through all that?
No, it doesn't sell more books. It just takes up time during the day. Asking you questions, you get obsessed with it. You know how we're obsessed with our phones? You see everybody walking around doing this on the phones. It's like a mental disease. We all have to do it. When you hear ping, oh, that's a message. And so I'm thinking, right, I need to make space in my life for actual real things, you know, like you get rid of all this stuff, because you end up with like 300 messages every 10 minutes of people who read the book, or somebody this or somebody that, are thinking, right, okay, I've got to get shot this. So that's changed my life completely there. And the other thing is, and this is it's a very good question, because I hadn't expected, and it's difficult for me to use this word, because it's not really what I'm not haughty type of person, but it's difficult to I hadn't expected to become a member, even though a lower member, if you like. I hadn't expected to become a member of the, I don't know what you might want to call it, a celebrity class of people who are sort of well known in public eye. Hadn't expected that. I just thought, well, there's a book, you know, we sell a few thousand, it'll do all right. At least I've got that out of the way. But I hadn't expected to become this media interest person. And what the publisher is very good, you know, he's John Blake's been around, you know, years and years and years, and he's published books about all sorts of people, and he knows what he's talking about. And he said to me, you know, your life will change. Once they've written about the book, they'll find other things to write about. And, you know, so-called friends at school will come out and say things that aren't true about you, and you'll get trolled all over the internet and all that stuff. It's normal. It's a sign that that the book is success, because people are talking about it. But I hadn't expected any of that. And I hadn't expected people that I spent time with at school to be so nasty about things. But anyway, I'm not angry. I'm not bitter. I'm actually quite relaxed about it. But it's something that I wasn't ready for. I would say to you guys out there writing a book, if it becomes something of a media interest, your life will change, because it's like a turkey shoot. You know, you put your head up there and someone's going to ping, have a go at you for no real reason. You know, I mean, I haven't said anything bad about anyone in the book, but apart from the obvious, you know, that, you know, Don Pablo was a nasty bloke. He was a bad guy. So it's not a problem saying that. So there's
security or anything like that.
Well, it's not really to say something live on a program like this to discuss my personal security, to be really honest, wouldn't be appropriate. But it does change your life, and you have to think carefully about what you're doing a little bit.
Sure.
And not for any other reason, but the fact is that the human psyche is a difficult thing to comprehend, but there are people out there that don't like other people being a success. And that is, that becomes an issue, and you just have to be a little bit more careful. I don't have any obvious, if you like, security. I don't need bodyguards standing at the door or anything like that, which I had in Spain. But I have to be a bit more sensible. You know, woke up on, I had a little doze on the beach, you know, on the old sunbeds with the wife the other day, and somebody woke up, someone was taking photographs. So I have to be a little bit careful about how I react to that, because when you react to it, it goes online and all the rest of it. So it does change your life. Now, look, let's be positive. Everyone that I know, and I mean this, everyone that I know that I've spoken to, and the hundreds and hundreds of messages I get, they all say, amazing page turner. I can't put it down. You know, it's a great book. And I was like really taken aback, thinking, wow, that's pretty cool. And then there's a few people who, to me, is obvious, they haven't even read the book, and they just trash it. Well, that's fine. Let them do it. It's not something I'm going to get, you know, all worried about, because it just means that there are people talking about it. Now, obviously, the matter that is obvious is that, you know, there's this Colombian side to my family that I don't know, for obvious reasons. As you can imagine, I'm an Englishman. Well, that they perceive it to be a threat to their financial empire, no doubt. Well, what can I do about that? I've just written a book. You know, Uncle Roberto, tried to sue Netflix because he wanted to own the rights to the word Escobar and all this stuff. You know, I don't know these people. They're nothing to do with my life. I've had this, you know, a connection, and that's fine, and it's all in the book, and that's fine, and I've not said anything bad about these guys. It's just part of life. And you know, there are millions of people out there who are adopted or that find out, you know, that I've got messages from people on my phone who are actually 100% sure they're illegitimate children of Don Pablo. I mean, the way he behaved, he would have had, you know, so there must be at least 20 kids out there that he's fathered, the way he behaved. And for sure, and I'm in touch with two of them already, and it's quite interesting and quite exciting, you know. And when we get this COVID thing under control, it'd be nice to get together with some of these half-siblings. Mm. I've got massive, you know, opposition from the half-brother that was born within the marriage that Don Pablo had. But that's normal. It's to be accepted and expected. You know, we all knew that would be the case. It's not a problem. It's just the way it is. You often get families in turmoil. I mean, the Escobar family, or look at the Jackson family. They're all suing each other and stabbing each other in the back over the rights to Michael's records. They're all, you know, at each other's throats. This is not the first family to be at each other's throats over a book or rights to something or whatever. It's not unusual in these situations, because, you know, this book is going worldwide. I mean, you know, it will be translated into all different languages. It's having an incredible effect on the literary market, which I, to be honest, I'm no author, but I'm just quite surprised. It's quite incredible.
Okay, so we'll come back to all the critics and the chit chat and the noise and the family nonsense, because move away from that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I'm fascinated by is your adopted father told you in 1989, but you only wrote the book this year. And that fascinates me. That's a long time between finding out and fill in that gap. No.
Yeah, well, you're wrong, because I didn't write the book this year. And I've already said in this interview that I didn't write the book this year. So I think you'll recall that actually relatively recently, probably only about 4 or 5 minutes ago, I said that it took me a long time. The process started in 1994 with me writing down notes. You remember I said that earlier? Mm. And that is the process where it's started the writing. So I've been writing this book, if you like, since 1994, but it wasn't a book. It didn't start out as a book. I hadn't intended it to be a book. It was just a process to get through the mental health. You know, they said, go to art classes. And I thought, well, I'll be the teacher, because obviously I don't need to be taught how to draw. So I went and they made me a teacher to help me with the therapy. And I started writing down all these notes. and probably my medical records. There'll be notes about the things I've said to them. I don't know. But, you know, the book starts with that. It starts with scraps of paper, in my case, in 1994. And so it's a long process, but I have to stop because I've got 2 months in the mental health ward, can't deal with having to deal with my mother's death, stop. Depression, start again, this goes on. And it's a process. It's a process that's part of my life. I didn't just sit down and go, once upon a time, there were three bears and that's, you know, and that was it. It was a long, drawn out process of getting all this stuff out. And then there's massive gaps when you're doing this. And we didn't have the internet. So these huge gaps that needed to be filled in with research, which came later when we had the ability to do the research ourselves and not just trundle on down to the British Library and suddenly conjure up all these details. You have, that's all researchable. And so in the last...
We have had the internet since the 90s, though, haven't we? It's not like we got it last year.
Oh, yeah. You had the internet in the 90s in England, yeah. Right? But when, you know, you say we've had the internet, the average person did not have access to what I don't know, you might remember it used to be Ask Jeeves back in the very early days, and that was crap, you know, I didn't tell you anything. So, you know, there wasn't the access that we have now. So that's why in the last 4 or 5 years, it's been able to become a book. It's only in the last you don't quote me on this exactly, please, whoever wants to troll me about this now, it's just in the last five years, my wife will probably correct me, but in the last 5 or 6 years is when I've been able to actually sit down on this very same laptop we're talking on and actually start to write stuff. And of course, bearing in mind that English is technically my second language, I still can't spell. And thank God we've got these programs on our computers now that help with that. You know, Thesaurus, this sort of thing. Because, you know, I used to come out every afternoon and say to my wife, right, I've written another page, you know, do you want to hear it? And, you know, she'd sit there and say, you've written disembarking 4 times on one page. You can't say that. And I'm thinking, well, everywhere you go, you're getting out of something or going somewhere, or we came out of here and got into there. You run out of ways of saying these things. So Thesaurus helps with that, you know, because if you deliberately spell disembarking with 3 S's, it will come up with about 10 different options, which is quite useful. So that was very useful. But no, it's a massive process writing this book. For me, it was. Maybe some people just write a book in a year, but certainly not me. And if you look at the detail and the research of this book and all the dates and stuff, you can see that that's no way that's been written overnight. It took a long time. And yeah, gaps had to be filled. And that's where your editor, where the publisher provides you with, helps you.
Yeah.
You know, there are things about Don Pablo. I thought, well, I don't know anything about this guy. Oh, crikey, what am I going to do? I'm going to write about him. And your researcher helps you there because they do all that research for you. See, that's the shit. That's the trick. You get good people around you and they do all that work for you.
Right. And was there a time then? So I get the long journey. Was there a time, you said maybe in the last 5 years, where you thought, yeah, this is actually going to become a book and I'm going to launch it?
Yeah, and to be honest, that was when the time, the there's not a hallelujah moment, but there's a moment where it dawns on you one day, shit, I've written a book. You know, I get to a stage where I looked up on Google what classifies as a book, and I think it said 40,000 words. And I'm thinking, right, I'm 38,000 words. I've still got a long way to go. Wow, this actually could classify as a book. I thought, well, no one's going to want this. It's just some mamberings and murmurings of some, you know, guy with all his memories. But, you know, if you see there's asterisks on one page and they refer it back to another moment and this stuff, those are things the editors help you with, and they help you turn it into the writings of a person with these memories and that. They help you turn that into what you see today, which is a book you can actually read, because my original manuscript, you know, it starts from day one and finishes today because that's how I wrote the book, you know. But you know, they turn it into something much more interesting, which is thank God, because otherwise it wouldn't be a rightly marketable book that it is today.
Okay, so why did you not just keep it all private? You know, was there some worries about sharing this to the world?
Well, worries is not really the thing. I think it's more apprehension. But this is normal, you know. An athlete, before they come out onto the track, they have this apprehension. Whatever you do, I'm sure, you know, before some of your interviews, you have a little bit of, whatever. There's that. And the realization that other people are going to be reading about your life is a bit, And there were moments where I just said, I don't want to do this. Yeah, no, let's not publish. There were moments, and, you know, the publisher would tell you, I had moments where I thought, shit, I don't want to publish this. And so, they help you get over the line with that, because there are moments, seriously, where you think, no, I don't want publishers, but they help you get over the line, and they manage and help you, and they're managing it today. You know, they help. There's this like screen of people that help you, and if you've got good publishers, I mean, they're not the biggest company in the world. They're not like Penguin or whatever, but they're good people, and they help shield you from, you know, this sort of, there are psychological trepidations, if you like, about publishing a book about your life. And anyone who's written a book about their own personal life and, you know, what they did with their mom and dad or whatever will tell you is there are these moments where you think, oh, no, I don't want to do this. But then their publisher helps get it over the line, you know, and that's what happened. And they carry it with you. You know, you become a team of people, and it eventually becomes a juggernaut that, eventually you can't stop. It just all just poof, and you get your box of 10 books. You think, bloody hell, I've got a book. What is this? And it's funny because I actually I've only ever read my book on a computer because I didn't print it out. I only ever read it on a computer. But when it arrived from the printers, and you feel it and you hold it and you open the first page and you smell the paper and you think, oh, and I start reading it, it's a totally different experience. It's really weird. It's almost like you're reading a book somebody else has written. It's very strange, very strange experience.
So you've launched this book. It's gone wild, selling out everywhere. You're all over the media. And of course, that's bringing out the critics like we said before.
How
does that make you feel when, you know, people are picking your story to bits, when old friends, family members, etc., are trying to discredit the story? How does that make you feel?
Well, there's that saying, isn't there, you know, you keep your friends close to you, but keep your enemies even closer. Well, I didn't know that had a meaning, really. I just thought that was some just bullshit bloody thing. But actually, there's a lot of truth in some of these sayings. And I thought to myself, and my publisher did say to me, warned me, he said, some people you think your friends, they turn out not to be. And, you know, I'm sure that a lot of people will tell you exactly the same thing. You know, you know, someone you shared your life with, you know, they go to the newspaper and suddenly there's a load of crap out there about you that you didn't even do, you know. So it just part and parcel of this new life that I've got, which is a best-selling publisher, which of course I wasn't prepared for at all, because really I'm just an artist, and I just get on with painting and, you know, sell to private collectors and that, and get on with my life. But this has changed my life. You know, it's going to become a movie, absolutely, almost 100% sure. I can't say any more than that because we're in the middle of all that. But, you know, this is incredible. I cannot understand how this little book that I've written has turned into such an amazing mammoth thing. But you are right. It brings out the trollers, and it brings out all the, you know, people who are negative about it. You know, there's a couple of guys who I went to school with who I didn't know. You know, they were in a different year. I mean, but they make out they were my school pals. You know, that's a load of old rubbish. But, you know, it's their moment. They're having their bit of notoriety in the press. Good for them. Well, I don't feel bitter towards them at all. But, you know, I have been warned that this would happen, and it has happened. So what can you do? But everyone who has read the book, and I don't know, have you actually read the book, Rob, or just...
Oh, yeah, I told you I'm waiting for it on Audible. Remember we had that conversation?
That's got to happen. That's got to happen. You know, they've got to get me to read. They've got to get me to read the book. And the COVID thing's caused that, because normally they fly me into the studio, as I was going to come into your studio, if you recall. They fly me into the studio, and then you sit there for 3 days, you know, reading the book. and then they edit it all out, and then you've got an audio. So I don't know what they've got planned, and whether they're going to send me to a studio in the place where I'm living, or what they're going to do. But it's going to happen quite soon. I know that the translation rights are coming. That's quite exciting. That's going to happen quite soon. So it's going to come out in different languages, and I know that it's going to be launched in America soon and all the rest of it. But yeah, I had not expected this, and it has brought out trolls. But on the other hand, it's brought out a lot of people that can empathize with the story of this little boy. And the one other thing that I did not expect, because when I was writing this book, I thought that this would be a book that wives or girlfriends buy their boyfriends and husbands for Christmas or whatever. Oh, yeah, man book, you know. But no, this book has been read by thousands of women who empathize with the emotional problems that this chap has gone through. And I, you know, I've had people come to me and say, I can really identify with the problems, and that, you know, you're a guy that is an example to us all, to show us that we can actually make it in the world and go through all that shit and come out the other end, and, you know, and turn that story of that man and the terrible things that he did and the things he caused in the world today, turn that into some money that will go into helping kids with these problems today. And, you know, I've signed a contract. I'm not just talking about it. I have signed a legally binding contract to divert funds from the book straight to these charities. And I think that's important. And it won't stop. You know, that's good. That's going to carry on until the last book ever is sold.
So when I announced this to my community, they were really excited about it. And everyone was like, this is great. But what was weird that came out of the woodwork was a few people approached me, you know, people who are sort of in your past, and they were like quite against it. One person told me that the date on Company's House for your birth date didn't add up with your actual birth date.
Yeah.
And I think, could you sort of let us know what the discrepancy is there?
Well, that's all in the book, as you well know. I've explained it.
And but can you tell us? Because I got a lot of people wanting to know.
Well, they can read the book, can't they?
But can you tell us?
Well, I can. But what I don't want to do is get into something and then, because I'm actually a human being, despite what some people may say about me, and I have faults and I have memory problems, and I sometimes forget dates and times and all the rest of it, just like all of us. So the problem with you putting me on the spot is that, you know, I'm going to say something and then 100,000 people go, well, that's not what he said in the book, you know, all this sort of crap. You know? I'm not going to fall into a trap where you're going to get me to say something and then I've got it wrong. So what I will say is...
It's your chance to have your say, isn't it? You know, this is your say.
I've had my say in my book. No, don't worry about that. That's going out around the world, just like this this podcast. So I've had my say in my book. I don't need to respond or defend myself. The book is there. And I would say, if you have an issue and a problem about Company's House, and you're talking about Oric. About Oric. Now, let's get into this. All right. There's a bloke out there, right, who went out to Colombia. His father was working for my dad. They worked for the same company, and he's got a real problem with me, and he's got some mental problems with this because he can't deal with the fact that there are issues between my adopted father and his father, and unfortunately, my father was his boss, and there were issues and problems which had to be dealt with at the time, and that bitterness and anger is still going on in this guy, and he's contacting anyone he can, including you, and trying to slag it all off and make out this and that and the other. The issue about the dates is well covered in the book. I'm not going to get into it right now. What I will say to you, just to sort of try and satisfy you so that you move on to something.
It's an interview. It's your side.
Yeah. It's not my chance to have a say because I've had my say in the book. Right. That was my chance to have a say. And it was my chance to have a say with more passive, detailed explanation. Now is just an interview where we're having a casual chat about my life. The details about what happened and relating to my date of birth is all in the book. And it's to do with my father, my adopted father, and his application for my British citizenship. But it's all in the book, and I'm not going to fall into the trap of making mistakes here today. If someone wants to find out all the details, read the book. And that's simple. I appreciate you asking me the question because it is It is a thing that this Oryk fellow wants to pick up on all the time because he wants to try and cause trouble. Well, you know, some people just get bitter and they get more and more bitter every day and they try and try and try and try and cause trouble. You know, I just ignore him because he's just causing a lot of trouble. If he crosses the line, the authorities will deal with him, but he hasn't crossed the line yet.
Okay. So there was a picture I saw where you had your dad's OBE, but there was we couldn't find any records of the OBE.
So we're back to the Oryk issue again, yeah. Is the same guy?
He didn't, I suppose.
I will say this. So there's the same guy who picked me up on this. This guy really has got some serious problems because of what happened to his father what I will say about that, I'll answer your OBE thing in a minute, because I actually realized there are two things. When I went to the house, when my mother died, you know how you look through the boxes and stuff, and this is quite a normal thing, and the lawyers let me go to the house and pick up some stuff and what have you, and I did, and I found this medal. And I thought nothing of it, put it in a box, took it home. And then I remember the time when Princess Anne came out to Columbia and awarded Dad something. I was only a small child, and my godfather something. And I put two and two together and I thought, well, this must be the case. Having said all that, you are right. It's not in the Gazette. And I don't understand whether that is an OBE awarded to him or whether I don't understand it. So immediately, and you'll notice that's not in the book, immediately I realized that it is possible that I was mistaken. If I am mistaken, I withdrew that comment and I don't have an issue with it at all. But sadly, this Oryk fella keeps going on about it, contacting everybody. He's a liar. He's this and that and the other. Well, you know, we all make mistakes. It's possible that Dad didn't get an OBE. I don't know. Right. Mm. It's not in the Gazette. I don't know if they have a thing for overseas awards or whatever that isn't in the Gazette. Something else. I don't know. I know that my godfather got an OBE as well. But I mean, you know, it's not recorded in the Gazette thing. So I don't understand that. But it's not a problem. I don't have a hang up about it like this fella does. And if you're listening, John, you know, you just you're wasting your time, mate. It's not a problem whether Dad got an OBE or not. It's not a problem. I don't care whether he got one or not. I did think that he got one. If he did, he did. If he didn't, he didn't. Who cares? It doesn't matter. It's nothing to do with the book anyway. So we're here to talk about the book and my life.
Okay, so let's move on to your art part then. So on your website, it says you're a modern master and you're an artist, I believe. So what is a modern master?
So I was with in the very early days of like websites and stuff. So we're talking about 90, whatever, sort of late 90s or something like that. I was with a friend who knew more about computers and stuff than I did. And we were he said, right, I'm going to set up this thing called a website. And I knew nothing about this stuff. And he said, well, you've got to have a tag. I didn't even know what that meant. So, and he said, well, let's call you the modern master. And I said, well, all right, if you say so. And so that's kind of just that. That's all. It doesn't mean anything really. It just means that I'm a master of my trade and I've mastered it. And I have mastered my trade. It took me a long time to master it, but now I can sit down and paint, blah, blah, blah. It's not a problem. And I do relatively well from it. But the name Modern Master is not something that I've awarded myself as some kind of, you know, big shot. It's not like that at all. It was a name that was used as a tag, apparently. I don't even know what a tag is, but it's something that you put on the behind the scenes I don't understand it. But anyway, it was a bit of a joke, to be honest. But it's stuck and it's still there. I mean, if it offends too many people, you know, I can take it off, but I don't see how that can be offensive unless you've got a problem.
I was just fascinated. So it also says that you're the last disciple of the Reynolds family. Because I know you wanted to talk about your art on the show and not just the book. A generation of artists led by Sir Joshua Reynolds, the founding president of the Royal Academy of Arts in London. So can you tell us about that lineage, your family history with
when you say lineage, it's about the art. It's not about genetic lineage. All right. There's a difference when you're describing art and the, and your provenance in art. You don't you're not talking about genetic lineage. So if this is the same guy coming back to you, we're trying to find more problems.
No, this isn't all about John Orrick, just so you know. I have my own questions.
Bloody John Orrick, keep on. I mean, you know, it's amazing how many people believe this idiot. But, you know, at the end of the day, when you describe art, you describe people who've worked in the studio of, which is quite common. I worked in the studio of R.P. Reynolds, Roy Peter Reynolds. And Roy Peter Reynolds is the great, 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 great grandson or whatever, how many greats it is. I don't want to be shot out of the airplane because I've got too many greats in the great, but it's so many greats, grandson of Sir Joshua Reynolds, and they were, you know, related. And Roy Peter Reynolds had a studio in Herefordshire. And I don't know, dad being my adopted father, but he knew him, but he knew a lot of people. And he got me to art classes. He got Roy to agree to teach me how to paint and draw, which is great. And so I went to work in his studio from school. I used to cycle from my boarding school in Lupton School in Herefordshire. And it was a feral cycle into the countryside. And I used to cycle to his studio twice a week for quite a long time until he had to go away and work in South Africa because he'd done some work for the police.
Okay. So this is going to sound like a random question, but it's just in my head. This isn't John, by the way. This is me. But you're sporting the moustache, and that obviously makes you look a bit more Pablo-esque. Have you always sported the moustache?
Right. This is from from you. Well, I mean, you know, what I will say is that you won't have pictures of me from when I was a very young adult, but I have photographs of me from when I was fresh out of art school, and I had a moustache. Mm. That simple. I went through a period where I decided I didn't want to have a moustache, and that period was a period of about 6-7 years, and it was mainly during the time when I was having some mental health problems, and I just decided to shave my moustache off. But then I just said, well, I'll go back to how I've always been. And you know, most of the pictures of me with my children growing up, I've got a moustache. It's just I've always had a moustache since I've been an adult. There was a period of time, you know, in my life where I didn't have a moustache. I can't remember exactly off the top of my head. I could research it for you and get back to you if you want, but how many years it was. But it was a few years where I decided not to have a moustache. I think it started with being in denial about the whole issue of being Colombian and everything. And I went through this sort of denial period. But, you know, you must never forget who you are. And I've always had a moustache apart from that. Yeah, I've been accused, and I know the question has a connotation to it.
No, it doesn't.
I've been accused of trying to do this and for marketing and all that. It's all bollocks. So I actually just have always had a moustache, apart from the time when I was in denial, which is about 5 or 6 years. But don't quote me exactly on that because I can't remember exactly. But there was a period of time where I shaved it off. And, but I just decided at the end of the day to just grow it back.
Mm. So, I mean, you've got...
It was easy.
Yeah. If you think about it, you've got a life up to the age of 24, which you didn't know who your real dad was, and then a life after 24, then you didn't know who your real dad was, and then, of course, you've got your adopted dad. And, of course, you've got your art career, and now you've got this book. So do you think this has given you some kind of imposter syndrome or how has it affected your identity of who you are?
I absolutely resent that question, the way you put that in. You slipped that word in. Can you just say that again? What did you just say? That one?
That's the softest one.
Why did you say imposter
syndrome? I didn't know who my
dad. Where the hell did you get that?
I don't know. You don't have to ask.
You're trying to suggest that I have got mental health problems and I've got...
I would never do that. I'd never suggest that. That would be wrong.
Yeah,
mental health issues is
There are a lot of people out there that suffer from quite serious mental health problems, and it wouldn't be good to get involved in that area in a sort of a hostile interview. What I will say to you is that I've always had a life that I've known about, which is unusual and not normal, if you like, in the sense of a middle class Englishman growing up in England. It's weird, but it's not anything to do with imposter, which is the word you use, which I take great offense to.
I didn't call you an imposter. I said imposter syndrome.
You're a professional and journalists do this as well.
They're I'm not a famous. Journalist. I've never done any journalism in my life.
No, but you behave like one sometimes. And I will say this. I will say this. There is this other half to my life, which is quite weird, which I can't ever beat down now because I've written this book. So there is this kind of double issue going on. Yeah, but it's not a difficult thing to deal with. It's just part of life, and you just get on with it. And a lot of people who have grown up abroad and then come back to England have this other life that they had in India or this other life that they had in South Africa and what have you. And it's all good. It can be a book, you know. A lot of people have written books about the time when they lived abroad and had a different life. I had a farm in Africa, you know. It is normal in the expat community to have had this other lifestyle.
The sentiment of the question. To help other people who might be wrestling with that conflict.
Yeah. Well, my advice would be, if it's only my advice, not because I'm a great expert, but because I've had all this experience of going through the mental health problems, my advice would be to just, even if you don't intend to write a book about it, write it all down somewhere so that it gets out of your head. And then when you read it through, what you're doing is you're coming to terms with the stuff that you've written down. And so that it's now recognition syndrome. You recognize something. Before it was just in here. Now it's out there. You're reading it back to yourself and you think, shit, did I do that? Oh, crikey. And that's, you become a separate person to the problem. And then you can read through it and deal with it. And if you want to just delete it all afterwards, that's fine. In my case, it got put into a book.
All right, look, we've been going for 1 hour, 8 minutes, and I'm sure, you know, you've got many other interviews to do, Roberto. So thank you for your time. Can you just give us a final shout out for your book and where we can get it?
You can buy the book in most stores, in most shops, but Amazon will sell it. Just look it up, you know. There it is, written by Roberto Sendoy Escobar, which is my Colombian name. And it's, it's out there. Go and get it on Amazon and read it. Listen, I will say, you know, just finally, look, I can live with any criticism once you've read the book. It's a free world out there. Read the book and then just, you know, say what you think about the book. All right. And be constructive and sensible. And that's fine. We can all live with that. Not a problem at all. I just hope that you enjoy it, buy it and enjoy it and get your money's worth. That's what you'll do. And then the movie will be out soon. So, the next 5 years, and you'll be able to watch that as well.
Roberto, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Cheers. Bye-bye.